Yes, certainly. And Jackie, it's lovely to be here. And certainly your contribution and the Completion Club had a big influence on the book and on my getting to a place where I'm feeling that I could write well enough and able to publish. So I'd like to thank you for that.
It made
a huge difference. What was the question?
Really, just to sort of give us a bit more of a flavour of the book, really, from your perspective and what the focus is.
Right, the book is actually the underlying issues why children who've been adopted from the care system are reconnecting with members of the birth family from whom they were removed by the court. And it's the underlying stuff. It's not the superficial stuff about setting how you set your Facebook settings. It's the motivation for the child and for the members of the birth family. Why is it that they want to reconnect? What's happening? Why? How is it happening? And what are some of the consequences? And what are the learnings to be had from this that we can take into the adoption world and transform current practice? Because I believe that unless current practice in the adoption world changes, then Facebook has the potential to blow adoption out of the water completely.
Mm-hmm. In terms of your own motivation to write it, was this just an issue that you could kind of see exploding and affecting many people that you knew?
The answer to that is yes, and I'm an adopted parent. I have three adopted children, and they were contacted by a member of their birth family unexpectedly via Facebook, and it has had dramatic effects and dramatic long-term effects. And at the time it happened, I didn't know of anybody else that it had happened to, and I mentioned it to many of my friends in the adoption world who went, oh, my goodness, gosh. And then within a few months, they're phoning me up and saying, Helen, you're not going to believe what's happened. And because Facebook has grown exponentially, you know, half the population in the UK have a Facebook profile. So the ability to reconnect with people is just happening all over the place. And one of the areas that's been affected is adoption. And it is the way that the reconnection is happening that is so difficult for adopted children and adopted teenagers. And some of them are young adults, some of them are teenagers. In theory, with Facebook, you can only go on Facebook when you're 13, but you just put in the full date of birth and you can get on. And certainly there are lots of kids on there at the age of 11. And tracking somebody down on Facebook is very easy. You can just put their name in, you can put their date of birth in, and you just do a bit of trawling. And you just sit there in the comfort of your own home and trawl through the internet, and then, bang, you can find the right person. And if you think, well, you know, you send 100 emails, and if one of them hits the person that you're after, bingo, you've done it. So, and that happened to me. And because I've been involved in the adoption world, you know, wearing a variety of hats, for a long time, I am aware of what goes on, particularly for adopters with older children. And the press have a tendency to focus on the placing of children and the young infants, but actually adoption is a lifelong issue. And for children who've come from the care system, they will have experienced abuse and or neglect. You know, they're not the adoptees that you see on current television programs being reunited with birth mothers who had to relinquish them. These are children who were forcibly removed by social services and by the courts because they were abused and neglected by their birth family big time. It's not minor stuff. It's the baby Peters that don't die.
Yeah.
These are the children that become adopted. So they come with a lot of baggage. They come with trauma, they come with a fairly distorted belief system and map of the world and how they perceive the world and adults. And it raises all sorts of issues for the adults who have to care for them and parent them.
So Helen, in your book, there was obviously a real sense of urgency for you to write this, given how, you know, very current this issue is and how it's changing all the time. But presumably, I suppose what I'm getting at is, what is the aim of your book? Is it to help those parents who may find themselves in this situation.
Yes, it is. It is certainly to help the parents who are in the situation, and foster parents who will also find themselves in a potentially a similar situation. It's also for teachers, for social workers, because the book isn't just about the impact of Facebook. It actually looks at, well, how do these kids who are affected by trauma, who've experienced this neglect and abuse and maltreatment, how has this affected them? And they have a distorted way of thinking. They often have very poor empathy skills. They have their socialization skills will be challenged. Their brain will be wired for trauma rather than normal. And so their behavior is often very erratic. It seems to make no sense until you drill down to underneath as to what's really going on. And for many of these children, they didn't have their developmental needs met. And I use a metaphor in the book of a wall and say that what children need, their needs, you kind of build like a wall. And the foundations under the ground are actually the experience in the womb, which for many children can be quite toxic because of drugs and alcohol and stress hormones. And then on top of that is built, let's say, you know, every year there are different needs that need to be met. And normal, good enough parenting will put those bricks in place and the child will grow up securely attached and be fine. However, for a child who lays in a cot for 3 days and isn't fed, or for a child who is screamed at and shouted at, or is witnessing horrific domestic abuse, those children will be traumatized by that experience, and those needs will not be met because they won't be safe. They won't have their need for food met on a regular basis, the need for cuddles, the need for security. And so their wall gets built with lots and lots of holes. So when they are placed with adoptive parents, the adoptive parents need to fill the holes as well as undoing some of the damage from the trauma. So it's a big task being an adoptive parent, which is why parents have to be therapeutic parents rather than normal.
That's a phrase you use in the book, which is therapeutic reparenting, and presumably that part of what, you know, what the book is also aiming to do, to explain what that is and how it works. And I know we had a conversation earlier in the year, because I have adoption in my family, a couple of adoptive relatives, and we were talking about the need to tell that child the truth of what happened in their early life as well, and that really struck me as a very strong important message.
Yes, the therapeutic reparenting, the therapeutic is about undoing the damage, and the reparenting is filling the gaps. And certainly truth-telling is a really, really important part of that. And children who are adopted very often will come with a life storybook. And the life storybook says something like, you know, well, your mum loved you, but she couldn't look after you. And, you know, sometimes she got a bit angry. And that's next to a photograph of a child blowing out some candles on a cake with birth mum, both of them smiling. So a few years down the line, it's really confusing for this child who thinks, well, all mums get a bit angry sometimes, and she looked quite happy there. So why couldn't I stay with her? Because the life storybook doesn't actually have the fact that he was left, you know, in the cot with no food, that there was domestic violence going on, and that actually he got taken to A&E 3 or 4 times, and that she was responsible for breaking his arm in 3 places. That's not there. So that the child doesn't have the matching of the good stuff and the ghastly stuff. And it's not about painting birth parents as bad people. It's saying this is what happened, and there could be all sorts of reasons, but this is what happened to you, and that's why you were removed. And one of the other things that we now know is that the body keeps score. The body holds onto trauma. Trauma is stored in the body. It's not stored with language. It's stored in the emotions. It's stored in the senses. And so the child knows in their body that things were not okay and bad things happened to them, but they don't have the coherent narrative to go with it. They don't have the story that matches their own experience. And that mismatch is enormously confusing. Mm. And that's why truth-telling is so important. And children need to know the truth of their history delivered to them in a way that's age-appropriate.
Well, you know, thanks for kind of giving us that overview, Helen, because it's, you know, it's obviously an issue which is just sort of burning, really, and just, you know, could really transform lives to actually get the right information to these parents as well. I'm interested, given that we're talking to writers today, and that there must have been a real sort of sense of urgency for you to get this book out there. It seemed to me it was great for me, because I know one minute you were writing the book, and then, you know, and at one point I think you were struggling to write the book, and then suddenly it seemed to me this book was here, which was amazing. Somewhere along the line you must have just kind of pushed through some kind of barrier. I'm kind of interested in that process of how you got that book written as quickly as you did and out there. Was it to do with the urgency of the message? What was it that kept you motivated?
I think it was a combination of things. I mean, as you know, I had been writing a book, and actually that's the book I'm working on now, which is now my second book, the one I'm working on now, which is currently at 18,000 words, and it is only the first draft, so we know what that means, was about parenting adopted children. And when the Facebook issue arose, it was such a shock for everyone that the path for it happening was I spoke at a conference and then spoke at another conference, and people were saying, wow, this is amazing. And there was a Radio 4 All in the Mind program with Claudia Hammond that did a half-hour special on the impact of Facebook on adoption. And they came to a conference I was speaking at, and I gave an interview. And driving back from that, I thought, I would be able to utilize that. And decided that I would write an e-book. And I wrote a 39-page e-book in 10 days to go along with, to come out at the same time as the BBC program.
Yeah.
And then decided that actually I needed to write a proper version of that book. So I parked the other one and picked this one up. And it was interesting because I didn't know what shape it was going to be. I didn't have an ending in the way that I would have liked to have done. And I think I put it together as almost spokes on a wheel. And there are 20 relatively short chapters. The book's 60,000 words. And it also has a lot of diagrams. It has metaphors, it has graphs. I'm very visual in what I do, and for the fact that I'm a trainer, I present things and use slides, and I think that is a good way of getting the message across for this sort of medium.
Mm.
And I put it together, it's almost like a training course or a presentation that I might have done, and put dots in, and allow the reader to join the dots, because something that's in chapter 3 may also then be relevant in chapter 5 and then also in chapter 17. Mm. So, for example, I talk about empathy, and empathy is something that's needed by both adoptive parents. And it's one of the things that's lacking in birth parents. So that's something that pervades through, and that's how it really came about. If that answers, does make sense?
I mean, I think what I'm thinking about is it's quite interesting, this idea that when there is a kind of a real reason to write the book, or when there is that sense of urgency, somehow it happens. I had an interesting story last night about a guy who was submitting to a one-act play festival. And he'd written a play, and 24 hours before the deadline, he actually, he lost it from his memory stick. And he couldn't bear to write it again, but he thought, I'll just do that other idea. And he wrote this one-act play in 24 hours, which I saw last night, and which was fantastic. And it made me think, gosh, you know, he so wanted to enter this competition that he did it. And I think it seems for you, the fact that you knew, I'm wondering whether the fact that you knew it was urgent, you knew that there was that media interest out there, you knew that it was needed. It sounds as if it kind of cut through all of that sense of discipline.
Well, I think, yes, there's an element of that. I think there's also an element that while I was working on it, I was probably processing my own stuff as well. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that the government is talking about making changes in the adoption world, and I was aware that there were some government announcements that were scheduled. They were actually originally scheduled for November, and I was trying to get the book out for that. Now, I didn't manage that, and actually the announcements didn't happen. And the shifting for when announcements are coming out from the government does make it slightly tricky. But the book, in fact, came out, officially it came out on the 2nd of January. Mm. And then on the 5th of January was the front page of the Times that said Facebook threats to adopted children, with an article by Rosie Bennett, the socialist affairs correspondent of the Times, and that then continued on page 6, and other media picked it up as well. And I think you're probably curious about that. I'd spoken at a conference an event in October in County Hall, mm-hmm. about hosted by the lawyers Osbornes, and Rosie Bennett chaired it, and the Times have been running a campaign about adoption, mm. and the title was Adoption, the Next Headline, and there were a number of speakers, including myself, and I raised the Facebook issue along with the impact of trauma being a key factor in adoption, mm-hmm. and it was something that Rosie and I then had several conversations about, and just before Christmas we had a two-hour phone call and talked about the impact of social networking on Facebook, and then I knew there was going to be something in the Times, but I certainly did not know that it would be the front page, mm-hmm. so that was amazing. Quite amazing.
And that led to lots of media coverage in itself.
Oh, absolutely. I spent 2 days being a complete media tart, which was an enormous, enormous fun. An ITV breakfast, television sofa. I did the PM program on Radio 4 with Eddie Mayer. Various newspapers, some of which, came out and some of which didn't. Sky Television, and then I did an hour on Radio 3 Counties based in Luton, and an hour I went into their studio and did an hour with them, and it was fantastic. It really was, and it was lovely because writing, as you know, is such a solitary activity, and you become such a hermit. Mm-hmm. To have media attention and, a car coming, cars coming to pick you up to take you to, BBC and ITV studios. I mean, it's such fun. Mm. It lasted for 2 days and then that's it. Then you chip paper. But it was terrific. And it was wonderful that the topic got out there. And not just nationally. I mean, it was international as well. I did a radio interview for ABC in Australia. Mm-hmm. And it certainly, it was picked up by Reuters and all sorts of other people. So it was great that it happened in that way. And I think Facebook is, Facebook's sexy. Adoption is something that people find interesting. They're not the pink fluffy bit, which is very unreal. People focus on that. So putting the two together made it a story that the media were interested in.
I mean, it's interesting because I know that sort of most of the people on the line today and many members of the club are fiction writers. So obviously the rules of the game are going to be different in a way. But I still think, what's interesting to me about your story is the fact that at the end of the day, it was your networking over the years. As well as your good ideas and bringing those ideas together, which kind of got that story out there. Everything happens in increments. It's not sort of, that sort of being interviewed sort of across the world doesn't just sort of come from nowhere. It actually comes from your steady work over the years. I suppose it's that sort of tipping point thing in a way, isn't it? That suddenly everything comes together.
Yes. I think that's true. And I think yes, it comes. I think it's the incremental steps, and it's the fact that you've. I mean, in my case, I've been working with this for a long time, so I have a lot of knowledge and a lot of depth that's built up over the years, and lots of different perspectives, and it's almost like it's a micro niche with the impact of Facebook on adoption. Now there is a lot more depth to it, but the fact that I kind of know my subject, I think, makes a huge amount of difference. And I found myself, it's going to sound slightly arrogant, but I really enjoyed the hour in the radio studio at Three Counties, because it was long enough to be able to expand and being in the studio and actually having an interaction with somebody else, and there were a few phoning people calling in as well, but with the interviewer, was lovely, and it allowed the conversation to meander, and if something came sort of off the agenda, I still had the depth of knowledge to respond to it.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the knowing your subject and having really got inside of it over a period of time actually makes the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that also along with that is you're going to make the contact. And certainly I've had people who've said, oh, you know, I heard you speak a decade ago and blah, blah, blah. So that I think has made, for me, quite a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Tell me as well, Helen, about the whole publishing side of this, because presumably, again, I keep coming back to the sense of urgency in relation to the issue.
Mm-hmm.
That must have affected your decision in relation to what to do about publishing, because actually traditional publishers are going to be very slow. Tell me about MX Publishing and your relationship with them and how that worked.
Okay. I focused on... Sorry?
Sorry, still here, yes.
Okay, sorry, I had a bit of echo there. I was planning to self-publish for that very reason, that I wanted to get it out quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I explored one self-publishing route which ended in disaster. And MX Publishing are a very small publishing company who specialize in two things. They specialize in NLP books and Sherlock Holmes.
Bizarre, isn't it? That's bizarre.
It is, and Steve Emmett at MX has been absolutely wonderful. And when my planned route fell apart, I had a link with him through some other people, and I phoned him up and said what was happening, and he just said, yeah, okay, we'll do it. Just like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it felt, and that's how I recall it. I'd worked as a coach with one of his clients who'd written a book about healing throat cancer using chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and an NLP coach, and I was that NLP coach, and MX had published a book that he wrote, which was Bangers and Mash. So I was known through that route. And it was, there was a sense, they said, well, you work with Keith, and Keith's a legend, so yeah, we'll work with you.
Fantastic.
And they were fantastic. And they are, I mean, I don't know. Nowadays, I think the publishing world there are lots of different models.
Mm-hmm.
But I supplied him with, in effect, the completed text in a format in the format I wanted it, and within a week, it was up and available to be printed.
Wow.
Which was fantastic. And then when the media picked the book up, he just absolutely just rocked and set up a Facebook for Bubble Wrap Children, and was just on the media. All over it. It was fantastic and terrific. And he's continued doing that sort of thing, and certainly on the social networking side, and other opportunities. It's probably a bit early to say what they may be, but there's other stuff that's coming up, and it's just lovely working with somebody who's got, you know, good values and morals and actually thinks the book should be out there and has a passion for what he does and what they do within MX. So I absolutely fell on my feet, you know, and it's that thing, isn't it? When one door closes, a window opens. Mm. And it was fantastic. And I would not have been able to utilize the publicity had I used the self-publishing route.
Yes. Tell me, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, MX must have used print-on-demand facility, they are a publisher working for you, effectively.
Yes.
So that's a kind of interesting kind of melding of kind of new technology, but a publishing house.
Absolutely.
You know, I think there are new models emerging all the time.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm interested, before we open the virtual room to other questions,
mm-hmm.
just in, you know, you don't have to go into the details of your self-publishing experience, but have you learned anything from that you'd want to pass on to others in terms of what to avoid if people are thinking about self-publishing at all? Or was it just that you happened to pick the company, or...
I think it's a lot...
No names.
I think it is a lot harder than it first appears. And I've had conversations with people who've used other types, you know, other self-publishing models. And, you know, it looks quite good because you think, oh, well, you know, you're going to make an awful lot of, you know, a lot more money from it and therefore it's going to be more profitable. That may or may not be the case. Certainly I had the experience that the time schedules that I thought were going to happen didn't. I had problems getting hold of people when I needed to get hold of them. And I know that that's been a problem with other people with other companies that do self-publishing.
Mm.
I think, you know, you have to step away and think, well, what is it that you want to do?
Mm.
And my intent was always to have a book that sold a lot. There was no way I was going to spend this amount of time to have a book that, you know, 200 copies were sold.
Mm.
I always expected it to be, you know, a reasonable seller and global. That's the other thing that MX has done. They have got it up. I mean, it's completely global. It's Kindled and electronic in every format and shape that it can be done in. And that's certainly one of the things that I've become aware of, that on the face of it, it looks as if turning a book into an electronic book, is relatively easy. I think there's a lot more to it in terms of the formatting.
Yeah.
And it took about 6 weeks for that to happen, for it to become available electronically after the printing, which I thought was probably indicative of what's required. And it's not cheap to do it professionally. So I think if you having that learning and then mapping that across to the various, you know, companies or whoever that say, oh, well, we can do this for you, or just, you know, send the file in or just upload this and it'll all be fine. It's not that simple.
Mm.
It's the classic thing, isn't it? The devil is in the detail.
Yeah.
So I am very fortunate. I'm certainly not making as much money from it. You know, I'm not making huge amounts of money from the book at all. You know, it's fairly conventional publishing terms.
Mm.
But I do have a flexible set of people that I'm working with and a flexible model. And we did the author's edits a month or so after publication, because when it actually came out in physical form, because I really did rush it to get it out for government announcements that then didn't happen. And there were certainly some glitches in terms of presentation, and some of the charts and graphs did not look good. So I spent a lot of January actually redoing and re-editing and redoing that. So that, again, was quite a useful learning. Certainly on the next book, I will get a short print run before it kind of gets published properly. So I can, what it looks like in your hand as a book, as opposed to how it looks on the screen, is different. You know, silly things like margins or something that you think looks okay, when it's on the page, you think, God, that looks ridiculous. And the occasional paragraph that was gobbledygook, actually, and that you had to read three times. Thought, what? And, you know, having sent it out for peer reviewing and all those steps, I've done all of those. Certainly, one of the problems I had was proofreading. The proofreading was not to an acceptable standard. And, you know, and that was, you know, good money. So it's difficult. I think it's fairly complex.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important to sort of get all sides of the argument as well in that respect. And we've had quite a few people sort of talking very much sort of pro self-publishing. So I think it's good to sort of see that other side of things as well when people are weighing up their own decisions at the end of the day. On which note, it would be great to open the virtual floor to questions. I know we've got three other people here today. We've got Rowena and Denise and Louise. Would one of you like to jump in with a question?
Yes, hi Helen, my name's Denise. I must have missed you somehow at the beginning of the Completion Club, but hello anyway. I didn't realise, are the children therefore given the names of the adoptive parent or given their whole file? Is that what happens? Is that how they're able to trace the parent?
How children are able to trace their birth parents?
Yes.
Children will know, yes. You have to remember these are children who've come from the care system. These are not babies from a different country or relinquished babies. These are children who've been removed by the courts and by social services. And it is the common practice and the absolute correct practice that as much information is shared with the children as they get older. So they will know.
They will have paperwork and everything. I see.
They may have some of the paperwork.
Yeah.
But they'll have enough. And actually, if two sets of people want to find each other on Facebook, they will. And, you know, my understanding is that people have found old lovers and whatever and been roots of divorce and all sorts of things. So, you know.
I was really struck by what you said about photographs, what I interpreted as photographs, lying. And having just been going through my mum's home and going through some old photographs myself, and I was thinking, hey, how come, you know, that looked so happy, but I don't remember that, you know. And there are elements of what I thought you were saying there, you know, with one picture of the child with the mother, and it all looks, you know, they can put a rosy picture around it, and that wasn't their case. So I found that very moving. It was an exciting story, yours. I mean, you know, the way it needed to be taken up and the way it was taken up. Congratulations. I look forward to reading it.
Oh, thank you. Well, I hope you enjoy. And it's interesting. I mean, one of the things, you know, on the stories, you think about what we do as families. We take photographs at weddings. We never take photographs at funerals. And it's,
right.
It's an equally memorable family event.
Yes.
And maybe we should. I don't know. But I think...
I've actually enjoyed filming a couple of, funerals, in as much that it was coming from the heart. It was able to give the deceased person who was in a state of trauma, you know, a nice video. I was able to talk to the grandchildren afterwards and they could remember their granny and all that kind of thing. So from, you know, it was a nice present, affirmative present to be able to give to them. Yeah.
I think that sounds splendid. It sounds like a niche market, actually. Make some money, isn't it? Well, good luck with it, Denise.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Rowena. I was just interested, now that you've had that success with your first publication, I mean, are you going to go the agent route for any subsequent work, or are you just deciding to carry on as you are?
I think at the moment my gut feel is to continue as I am, in that for the second book. The second book is really going to be a partner, the Bubble Wrap Children. The second book is called Making Sense of Nonsense. And the two of them will fit together quite well. And my gut feel is that I will publish it with MX and you know, use that route. I mean, after that, who knows what the future holds and what I may write. I don't know, you know. I mean, clearly I'm open to offers from large publishing houses. You know, don't want to come and find me, of course. I'll talk to anybody. I think my concentration has been on getting the writing done, rather than working out that bit of it. And the other thing for me is, because I'm a trainer as well, the books are a platform and give me a great deal of credibility and authority in the adoption and fostering world. And it, oh, that Helen Oak quote, oh, she wrote Bubble Wrap Children, didn't she? And I know from years in this world that the people who get repeat gigs are the people who are authors. And so I'm aware of that, and that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write and publish. Mm-hmm. Does that answer?
Yeah, no, I mean, it seems like you've found a way to be successful in the fields that interests you. And so I was just curious to know how much you were going to kind of get prepared to get involved in the sort of publishing world in its wider context.
Well, I find writing enormous. I mean, I do find it quite difficult.
Yeah.
I'm on 18,000 words of the next novel and the next book. And I was saying to Jackie earlier that last week I find writing, well, certainly, and the partly probably the topic, because for some of this stuff I am processing my own experience as a parent, both now and looking back, and probably processing my own childhood. So there's a fair bit of work going on at all sorts of levels, because I'm quite honest in the way that I write, and I don't paint it all black, and I don't paint it all glossy pink. It's about being real. And I find writing is like wading through treacle, and sometimes it's ankle deep, and sometimes it's up to your chest. And last week, I think it was a chest day. You know, it was a chest week, and I gave up for a couple of days and just kind of went, and I've actually gone back to it this morning, having spoken at an event last night, and that remotivated me. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the things I'm realizing is that I need the input from other people to say, yeah, this is great, you keep going. And they give me ideas or phrases, and I think, oh, yes. Right. And that kind of keeps me going. And it's almost, once I finish the book, then I'll think, oh, so what happens next? And I think the next one will be with MX. I mean, I do have other plans further down the line, which might, you know, other larger publishers might be interested in, but I need to do these books first.
Yeah.
I think also, Helen, what interests me is this whole sort of speed thing as well. It's when you think about traditional publishing and how slow it is, and when you think about how fast-moving the contemporary world is and how quickly news changes and ideas, it's kind of, in relation to anything that's even a little bit newsworthy, the traditional model kind of doesn't work, does it really? It's like we can't wait a year and a half for certain books. We need that information now. And of course some messages are more universal, and I'm not saying that it will never work, but I do think that there is a real argument for the fact that there's a kind of mismatch there, and it's not always the right thing for a particular message.
I would agree. I would agree, and certainly for the stuff I'm with the Facebook, in a way, Bubble Wrap Children in 10 years' time, I would hope the Facebook element of it is no longer relevant, because the political messages that I've put in there, which is about you have to put in adoption support, you have to support birth parents, you have to support adopters, you have to support children, you have to do this therapeutic work, and you have to do it from early on. If that's happened, then in 10 years' time, the issue's not going to be there, because adoption will have a very different feel to it, and we will have facilitated contact. Now, you know, I'm sort of looking out and wondering if I'm seeing a flying pig over there, in terms of it actually happening. But those are the recommendations, because I have recommendations, 8 recommendations that I've made at the end of the book. So there is that side to it. So I think that side of it, I hope, will no longer be relevant. But the deeper content, the definitions of what a toxic parent is and what the position of a birth parent is like, and that they, you know, they are screaming. They've had children ripped from them. And the principles of contact, all of those things will still be valid because they are the deeper fundamental structure. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely.
And certainly I think publishing it's very difficult. I think publishing has got to become more flexible.
I actually had some friends over for dinner on Saturday, I think it was, who work in nonfiction publishing, and they were talking about sort of interns in the company and this sort of thing, and they were saying they didn't really like to encourage these young people in a career in publishing because they just felt that they almost were pretty much saying there's not going to be a publishing industry in 10 years. And I think what they meant, and I would like to press them a bit more on it, the conversation turned, but was actually that publishing itself is going to transform so much. It's not going to exist in the same form that it exists now because new technologies are affecting it so much. I mean, I will push them a bit more actually, because I'll be kind of curious to see where they do see it going. I don't think they meant that there are going to be no publishing houses, but that the role of publishing houses is going to be very different to now. Interestingly enough, one of them was from a big architectural publishing house, and she was actually talking about this huge amount of revenue that was actually coming from to a big publishing house from vanity publishing, I think from some sort of sheikh in Abu Dhabi or something like that, and it was sort of this huge contract, and they were having to bind the books in vellum and tip them with gold leaf, etc. So that was kind of interesting, though, to see that even a very traditional publishing house was, for example, dealing in vanity in what in the very old-fashioned terms, vanity publishing. So slightly off at a tangent there, but I do think it's kind of fascinating how things are changing. Louise, I just wanted to, before we finish, I just wanted to bring you in as well, because I know at the very beginning you talked about marketing and the importance of marketing, and I was thinking about how Helen was talking about, or how we were talking about this idea of actually networking in relation to marketing as well. And I know that, I know that's something that we didn't necessarily talk that much about when we talked about marketing. We often talk a lot about sending things out, but I think the person-to-person thing is obviously interesting. I just wondered if there was anything about marketing that sort of struck you today.
Well, I find what Helen was saying about networking and the publicity generated by the Times article, and then just being available for those 2 days so that she could give the interviews and, on radio and television and everything. Very interesting in that, Helen, you obviously got a lot out of that publicity as well, but you were at the right time and the right place and that you were available to do all those interviews, etc.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I certainly hadn't anticipated it. And other than standing up in front of a group of people and training, I think I would have cancelled anything I had in my diary and taken that opportunity. And I think one of the things that I hope I've done is formed some connections with other journalists. And I've said to them, anytime, you know, call me, you know, if you want to comment or if you just want some background information, just here's my number and I will be available. And certainly we sent out various copies of the book to various people on the back of that. And I think putting yourself in the shoes of the journalists, which is they're on ridiculous deadlines and they just need a story quickly and information quickly, and you need to keep it as simple for them as possible, and they're not interested in lots of the detail. Just trying to get your head around that and always being available and always being nice is then will develop relationships over time. Now, for me, it's a bit too early to tell, but I've had a couple of phone calls saying, "Can you do something?" And in fact, on both occasions, one, actually, I wasn't the right person to do it, and I said, "You know what? I don't think I'm the right person. I think I may be able to suggest somebody else because this is not, you know, it's not quite my area." Mm-hmm. And then the other one, I wasn't able to do it because of a previous engagement. And the person who said, "Oh, well, we'll get back to you again. Fine."
Yeah.
And I think that for me has been quite a valuable lesson. Do try and keep track of names and numbers and yeah. have a day book, write them mm-hmm. all down. I was learning that the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly. So I think it's that side of it. And also, one of the other things that is, I was thinking just kind of UK, and that got rattled by the phone call with Australia
yeah.
and discovering things were out on Reuters. And it is now a global world, and you have to think globally
yeah.
rather than just in your own sphere. And I'm noticing that in the second book I'm writing, I'm already phrasing things from a global perspective rather than a UK perspective.
Yeah.
Probably still fairly much more UK-based, but ensuring that I'm putting things in so that it's suitable for a global audience. Does that yeah. make sense?
Yes, completely. Thanks for that.
I think Angela Horne, who's a previous member of the Completion Club, who was one of my peer reviewers for the book, I have a metaphor about the Thames. And she said, you know, it'd be really useful to have a map of the Thames so that people know where it is. Because if they're in America, why would they know where Oxford is relative to London? It's like, well, and it was absolutely obvious when she said it and has made me step away and has started making me think, right, I have to use global metaphors rather than, you know, ones that are very close to home.
Yeah.
It's funny, it's made me think about the fact that one of my books has done better in Holland than here, and this bizarre fact that my third book is only available in Dutch. You know, it sort of shows that we are living in a strange global world, doesn't it? When I can sort of say, well, yes, my book is published, but in Dutch. You know, it's very peculiar. But Helen, thank you so much for sharing your experience. I'm so thrilled for you that it's gone so well, especially, you know, given the importance of your message as well.
Thank you. Well, I would like to say the Completion Club and working with you, Jackie, has made an enormous difference. I think the benefits of coaching and listening to other people who are also writing, even though it's a completely different genre, to find that other people are, you know, swathed in self-doubt and are thinking, oh my God, it's complete rubbish, and I'm all of that, hearing other people are going through that, I found really, really helpful. And the encouragement to find one's own voice and air your fears and doubts was tremendous. And realizing that the commonality of problems and issues for people who are writing, and that very often we are the people who get in our own way.
Mm.
That has been enormously helpful for me. And I used to listen to the, you know, these recordings.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Just
absolutely.
I remember you said you didn't often,
no.
weren't often able to make the calls.
No, I felt
to them. So it's very feels right that it's kind of come full circle. And
absolutely,
you're now.
And I have done several long. Car journeys with, you know, listening to these talks or you know, whatever component form they took, and every time I found stuff that was really useful and valuable.
Mm.
So I have to say I feel very honoured and privileged to have been invited to be interviewed, Jackie. So thank you very, very much.
Oh, I feel that one of those big group hug moments.
Helen, just a quickie. Did you say that title of the other book you contributed to was called Bangers and Mash, about
yes.
someone who recovered from throat cancer and
yes.
was speaking again? Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's Bangers and Mash, and the author is Keith Hearn, H-E-R-N, and it's published with MX Publishing.
Oh, right. Oh, yes, of course. MX.
Yeah, it's
okay,
through MX Publishing. And it's a good book. It's How to Overcome Throat Cancer Using Chemotherapy, Radiotherapy, and an NLP Coach. And it's Keith's journey through that path. And because he's a photographer, there are photographs as well, which make it.
Oh,
yeah,
great.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very helpful to me. Thank you. It's my pleasure. it's a good book. It's a good book.
Wonderful. Well, thank you all so much. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Helen, in particular, of course, but thanks to the rest of you for coming along and making it that much more interesting as well with all of your questions. I will be on the forum, I'm hoping, if not later today, then in the morning to catch up with you all. And, Helen, we will be in touch as well.
Thank you.
Helen, I'll make sure you get a copy of the recording too.
Lovely.
Play in your car.
Inspire yourself with your own.
Absolutely. Well, you never know. When you hear yourself back, you think, oh, that was a good phrase. Or, oh, no, I need a better phrase than that. Oh, yes, I will do.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you, everyone. I will be in
touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right,
thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.